One of the problems that I encounter teaching English 245 is the distance of all of these events. So many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, several millennia ago actually, the students have a hard time even connecting with what's going on. And so I put together a handbook to help them out with the history of the whole biblical world. So I think it's worthwhile we take just a couple of minutes and consider the history of the Hebrew people and give a kind of a big overview of who's who and what's what and what groups are invading and just all the things that are so difficult about the history sweeping through these areas so long ago. So let's start with the idea that the Hebrews are one of the groups of ancient people known as the Semites. And, of course, we go back to the story of Noah, three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Shem has his descendants. He was the eldest son of Noah. And there are a bunch of other nations that were considered Semites as well as the Hebrew people. There were some Arabians, the Assyrians, Phoenicians, and some other lesser tribes. So there's one big Semitic race, but they're divided in all these different nations and tribes. And then we hear about Abraham in the book of Genesis. So we're probably somewhere 1800, 1900 BC, something like that. Abraham is in the area called Mesopotamia. If you look at a map, the Fertile Crescent, somewhere in the Tigris-Euphrates River valleys. And gradually his family moves, migrates, and ends up in the land of Canaan. We call it today Palestine. We think of it as Palestine, but it wasn't given that name till much later, I think by the Romans. So the name Palestine, by the way, just is part, I guess it's actually the same, comes from the same word as Philistine. So they're in the land of Canaan now. That land is about the size of the state of Vermont. So we're talking about some crucial events throughout history occurring in a fairly small area. And they're nomadic people, living in their tents, going about their business, wanderers, moving if they have to because of famines and things like that. But it was a nomadic lifestyle. You can still see some of that with the Bedouin tribes today. Very tenacious of family and tribal loyalties. They were bumping up against people that are already there, the Canaanites. And kind of a mixture, I guess, of several different races and tribes, we're not really sure. And the battles were already underway. And so their real history begins probably something like 1700 years B.C. when they moved down to Egypt, probably because of famine, which is what it says in the New Testament, or I'm sorry, the Old Testament, in Genesis. And things are fine there for a while until new pharaohs come along that don't recognize the people and they lose a favored position. And there was a lot of upheaval during this time period, according to even Egyptian documents. And there was a lot of fighting going on. There were some outsider groups, maybe allies or maybe the actual people of Israel there in their land that they finally boot out. And Moses comes along about this time. So we're talking maybe 1300 BC, something along in there, with the time of Moses. And he takes the people out, of course, the great story of the Exodus. And one of the questions that always comes up, people look at these numbers of Israelites that are described as going off to their promised land. And some verses in Exodus 38 say something like 600,000 men. Well, if we add in the women and the children, we're talking probably near 2 million people, and that seems pretty bizarre. And so people have come up with alternate proposals. For example, if it says there are 45,000, it may actually mean 45 groups of people. And so some suggest there may have been something like 20,000 who actually left. Some people suggest, well, maybe that number comes from the idea of the dead and the living. In other words, when the people left, they took, remember Joseph, near the end of Genesis, says, when you leave the land of Egypt, take me with you. So maybe when they say all these hundreds of thousands, they're talking about all the history of the entire Jewish people, and that they, in a sense, they're all leaving together. So a little hard to tell, but if you jump ahead to Joshua 4, it talks about the Israelites crossing the Jordan River, and it's a far smaller number, something like 40,000. So my guess is that 600,000 maybe, we're not interpreting those numbers correctly. But whatever it is, they are out of the land, they settle in the wilderness there, they encounter God at Mount Sinai. By the way, I would suggest something that might be interesting for you to look at. There's an organization called BASE Institute, B-A-S-E, and they investigate a lot of biblical things. And what they've come up with, if you look at a map, they believe that the parting of the sea and all the things that happened occurred in the Gulf of Aqaba, not the traditional Red Sea site, and that Mount Sinai might actually be in Saudi Arabia today, not where we think it is, and where there's actually a monastery, St. Catherine's, that's been there for a long, long time. So there's another bit of mystery that you can check on if you're curious. But they get the law at Sinai, priesthoods are all set up, and they eventually head into the land, probably about 1100 or so, BC, sorry about that, BC. And here we go. They come in the land and they slowly push the Canaanites from their strongholds. And we can't think of this as total victory. They come in and they just slaughter and march their way across the land and set it up and have peace ever after. No, a lot of the land actually resists, and these Israelites only conquer small areas to start with, kind of a patchwork. Well, one of the things that's come up lately is the idea of genocide. I've heard that complaint. Hey, look at the Old Testament, it's genocide. They went in there and they wiped out the Canaanites. Okay, well, we need to think about this. I read some information on it that put it in a whole different light. What happened when they really entered the Promised Land? Well, it was actually more infiltration and struggle after they got in there. It was not like a slaughter in a vacuum that just wiped out the people. The idea of this all-consuming army just voraciously wiping out the Canaanites is not really what happened. There's a lot of hyperbole in the Bible and other forms of literature, and we see it all over the place. Well, it happens in the Old Testament, too. In Deuteronomy, see if I can find it here, Deuteronomy 10, Deuteronomy 2, so we captured all the cities at that time and utterly destroyed the men, women, and children of every city. We left no survivor. So you hear that and you think, aha, there's the genocide. Well, if that's the case, just go a few chapters later, look at chapter 7 of Deuteronomy, first few verses. Here's what you encounter. You shall not intermarry with them, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons. Well, if they've just killed all the Canaanites, how's that possible to have to worry about intermarriage? Okay, Judges 1:21 says the Israelites did not drive them out and lived near these Canaanites for a long time. So there are a lot of things can be said that shows this may not have been as big a wipeout as some people think. It seemed like I came across something else on that. Oh, the ones who were destroyed, people have read this, said the ones who were destroyed were the political leaders and army combatants rather than non-combatants. In fact, the towns of Jericho and Ai that are featured at the beginning of the attacks by Joshua were apparently military forts, not towns full of peaceful people. Plus, some of the battles fought were actually defensive. Other nations were attacking them. And then there are some verses that tell the Israelites, let the people surrender. Come to their town and tell them to surrender. And if they do, fine, you don't kill them. So that's just something to think about as far as what really happened. Was there genocide? It doesn't sound like it to me. Well, they break at least the overall strength of the Canaanites and begin to take over the land in their different tribal areas. You heard of the 12 tribes. They don't succeed. As I said, there are some of them that are more successful than others. And they have these judges coming along who are charismatic tribal leaders taking over. So people like Gideon and Deborah and places like that, if you look at the book of Judges. So, small area, they're still pretty rural, they're pretty backward people, pretty nomadic, and they're, at that point, they, around 1000, maybe 1030 BC, they ask to be like the people around them. They want a king. And they need a king because there's a new group for them to worry about. They're called the Philistines. And if you look at a map and see the progression of these people, they probably came from Greek islands, the Aegean. And they came along the coastline, gradually moving closer and closer until they had five cities that were on the Mediterranean: Gath, Gaza, Ascalon, Ekron, and Ashdod. Now you can see those five areas on a map of the ancient area there. So they settled in the coastal area, and think of them as the people with high technology. And the Jews would be the backward people who had to go down there and get iron weapons and things like that. They had chariots, and they were organized, so they were pretty powerful. So the Jews say, help us, we need a king to fight this, and so they set up their first king, and it's Saul. And there's Saul fails pretty miserably. You can read about that in the books of Samuel. After that, David, the most popular king, so much of the Old Testament is devoted to him. And I think of several reasons. He's the one who conquered Jerusalem. He's the one that lived during the time of great peace. He brought the ark back to the land and succeeded in a lot of different ways. Military leader, poet, lover of God to great extreme. And he was fortunate that when he set up the kingdom, the two opposing huge kingdoms to each side of him, Egypt and the Mesopotamian kingdoms, were fairly weak, and so gave David and then his son Solomon a chance to establish the area in between, the land bridge between those two areas. There was, of course, Solomon comes on known for the wisdom, but he apparently pushed his people pretty hard to succeed in the things that he did. He taxed them heavily and drafted them into his army and so on. And when he was done, his son had a chance to ease up on the people, and he took bad advice. And he said, no, I'm going to stick it to you even further. And so there are already fault lines among the tribes, and the tribes split at this point, and we end up a northern kingdom, which is really confusing, called Israel, and then a southern kingdom called Judah. And then we read about the kings of those two areas. And mostly we find that they weren't very good. They weren't very successful. Israel up in the north had a problem. There was a powerful and dangerous rival up there in Syria, and they were closer to Assyria itself. So they were always in a perilous situation. Who do they back? Who do they stay away from? And if they guess wrong, they get in huge trouble. We get some of the prophets coming along at this time. People like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea and Micah, and they're warning the people, get your act together, live right. But the people aren't. It's eat, drink, and be merry. And they're more interested in enjoying the good life and not thinking about their God. Well, we know what happens. First, the Assyrian nation rises. Capital city was Nineveh. They come sweeping into the land, and they take over Israel. That's the 10 northern tribes, and put an end to them. And the way their policy of conquest was pretty mean. They would scatter the people that they just conquered all over the kingdom and bring others into those places that they just conquered. So the poor northern tribes were hauled off for the most part, and foreign colonists came in and were kind of mixed together. And we don't know what happened to the 10 lost tribes. They got deported someplace. There's something called British Israelism in the 1800s that said, oh, the tribe somehow had made it all the way to England. And so that gave the British good feeling, right? Because, hey, we're descended from the 10 lost tribes. Well, that's probably crazy. But we don't really know. Another one of those biblical mysteries. So Judah now is hanging on. Well, not a lot longer. They made it to about 586 BC. By that time, the Assyrians had collapsed as an empire. The Babylonians had taken over. And they turned their attention to Israel as well. Well, Judah at this time. Nebuchadnezzar comes in, king of Babylon, laid siege to Jerusalem. And by 586, let's say, the siege was followed by complete destruction and ruin. Everything was torn down. The beautiful temple that Solomon had built was stripped. And again, the people were hauled off to exile. So this is the Babylonian captivity that you might have heard of. So about 50 years, roughly 586 to 536, they're in captivity. And it probably wasn't a terrible time for them, but, you know, some of them did want to go home, obviously. And so we get Ezekiel, who is a prophet to these exiles, talking to them. But he kept alive, in their minds at least, their faith that someday it would all be okay. And he made plans for rebuilding temples and things, the temple, and talked about the holiness of God. And somebody called him the father of Jewish ritualism and the forerunner of Judaism as a religious sect. So Cyrus, who's a Persian now, the Persians have come along and they've beat the Babylonians. By the way, you can think of these in alphabetical order if that helps. A for Assyria, then they're gone. B for Babylon, then P for the Persians. So Cyrus, the Persian, had a much better, kinder philosophy when it came to conquered peoples, and he allowed some of the people to go back home. So the exiled Jews had a lot of freedom, and some of them left. Now we get stories of Ezra and Nehemiah, of the people coming back. Of course, the land was in terrible shape. Everything was knocked down, and they had a miserable time of it, not a happy time at all. They tried to rebuild the temple, and Nehemiah, I guess, during this time period, I think he's a really interesting character. You might want to read about how his qualities of leader and what he did to make this thing work as he came back to Jerusalem trying to build it up here. So he brought new life and strength to that community in Jerusalem and gave the people some more faith. Okay, so now we've got it down to, let's say, the 300s. The Persian Empire is doing well, but not for long. Who's the next person that enters the scene? Pretty famous individual known as Alexander the Great. And eventually Palestine falls to him about 332 BC. And now Western ideas, especially what's called Hellenism, the ideas of Greece, come into this area. The Greek culture emphasizing the human being, the intellect and beauty and judgment. And so this is what clashed for these Jewish people who were suspicious of all of this. In I think it was like 170, 180 BC, a emperor comes along after the death of Alexander, known as Antiochus Epiphanes, and he loves this Hellenism, this idea of Greek culture, and he's going to bring it to the Jews, whether they want it or not. So he, for example, he forbade the ancient rite of circumcision. He would not allow them to observe the Sabbath. They couldn't offer sacrifices in the temple. He destroyed their sacred books. And in 168 BC, he committed the ultimate crime. Some people call it the abomination of desolation. But he took their sacred altar of the temple and set up an altar to Zeus and rededicated the temple to this Greek god. Well, the Jews who still knew who they were supposed to worship had a fervor and a desire to kick out these interlopers. And they set up a revolution. There was guerrilla warfare. It was called the Wars of the Maccabees. And if you read one of the apocryphal books of that name, you can enjoy the story of Judas Maccabeus, known as Judas the Hammerer. And they revolted, and they became outlaws and took to the hills and the caves. And amazingly enough, they won. They fought for almost a century. And the Syrian kings would look like they were winning, and then they'd die off, or they'd go off someplace else, and their armies would leave. And finally, the Maccabean revolution took place successfully, took over Jerusalem, restored the temple, and for a time, they got to rule themselves. Well, unfortunately for them, looming on the horizon was the Roman Empire. And Pompey, one of Rome's generals in 63 BC, laid siege to Jerusalem, and there went that city's independence for so long, and scattered the Jewish people all over the world. So that takes us up to the time of Jesus, and I know that's a lot of a lot of territory covered there, a lot of time, but at least it gives you kind of a sweep of history moving through the region. We can just mention briefly, Rome is in charge. The Jews settle in under that, not necessarily very happy to do so. Jesus makes a prediction that this beautiful temple that they have that was rebuilt by Herod is going to be destroyed. And the people think he's crazy to talk like that, but in 70 AD, you know the story, the Jews revolted against the Romans. Not a good idea. Nobody revolts very successfully against the Romans. They are methodical people. Once you're their enemy, they're a bulldog. And so they came in, surrounded Jerusalem to start with, laid siege to it. People estimate maybe 1 million people died during this siege, Jewish people. They successfully took the city, the Romans did, and trashed it, and literally did take every stone and rip it apart, so one stone did not stand upon another. So that was a tragedy for them. Some Jewish zealots tried to keep fighting. They ended up in Masada, a huge hill fort. I hope sometime you can see a picture of Masada. And they held out there against the Romans for some time, but they could see the Romans were going to successfully invade and conquer them and haul their women and children off to slavery, so they committed suicide rather than surrender. So it's a powerful story. It's Masada, M-A-S-A-D-A. Maybe you can take a look at it sometime. And that really takes us up through the majority of the New Testament account. So I'll stop at that point, let you catch your breath after that broad sweep of history.